Hello and welcome to the Majlis podcast, Radio for Breathe Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Radio for Breathe Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. Over the past couple of days, we have gone through another episode of tension on the Kyrgyz-Tajik border in Central Asia. Though things are now reportedly calm in the region, but it was a new level of escalation. An escalation in which, as my colleague Bruce Panier puts in his recent story, the fighting moved from sticks and stones to guns and bombs. It was an unprecedented development. As a result, dozens of people died, hundreds of people injured, villages have been torched, houses burned down to the ground on both sides. For a day or so, the whole area kind of looked like a war zone. Now, as people mourn the loss of their loved ones, authorities on both sides of the border accuse each other of unleashing the war. An equally tense debate is underway on social media between various commentators. In the meantime, days have passed. There is little clarity as to what happened and how things gotten to this point. On this Majlis podcast, we will look into these questions and also ponder around what comes next, what can be done to avoid these kind of situations from repeating, and what can help and who can help to resolve this tension. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Dr. Madeleine Reeves, a senior lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Manchester and also the author of Border Work. Madeleine lived in those villages. And also we are joined by Cholpan Uruzbekova, head of the Geneva-based Bolan Institute for Peace Innovations. Cholpan is originally from Kyrgyzstan. Hafiz Bobayorov, currently a guest researcher at the Bonn University in Germany and previously with the Academy of Science in Tajikistan. Hafiz's research focuses on collective identities and patronage networks in southern Tajikistan. Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlak Awazi, is also with us. Bruce is seen occasionally roaming around in those villages since the early days of Central Asia's independence. So thank you, colleagues, for joining us today on this very important conversation. So there is a lot to talk about what happened and how we got to this point. So Bruce, let's start with you. Could you please give us a summary of what happened and where we stand as we speak?
Well, this has been gradually increasing, the tensions along the border. I mean, it wasn't like that, you know. I mean, there was never a fixed state border that ran through this, you know, and people have been living here for thousands of years. But finally, there was an administrative border during the Soviet times. And then, of course, after the Soviet Union collapsed, it became the state border between two countries. Right. And I've had a hard time figuring out exactly where the border should be. But these tensions started to grow at least like 15 years ago, and maybe even longer, Madeleine would know. But certainly it started out as the usual arguments. That's our land. What are you doing with the water canal? Are you trying to divert water to your land instead of ours? Or, you know, if you build that fence over here, you know, then you're taking away some of our property, things like that. And it would be an argument that ended up becoming more than arguments. So fist fights. Rocks were thrown, you know, sticks and things like that. And it, you know, it really wasn't until, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago that the border guards actually, you know, usually the border guards were the ones that would come and break everything up and get people back to their own side of the border, which you couldn't see where the border was, but they'd move them back to some place that was there, you know, Kyrgyz and Tajik territories. But then they started participating in it too. And sometimes, admittedly, they would set up roadblocks and then abuse citizens of the other country when they tried to go past. But they started shooting at each other on occasions. It was very, very short. It was all over in a few minutes.
Certainly we are going to talk about the background history of this. I mean, I was just kind of curious about this latest tension. It was kind of new level of tension, as I can see from far away. So as we speak, things seems to be calm now.
Yeah, they are. But you know, to speak to that point, I was just trying to say that when this all started, no one would have thought very much about it. You know, it started, you know, last Thursday night, and it looked like the usual thing. We have an argument over something. In this case, a group of Tajiks was putting up a camera on a post, which appears to have actually been on Tajik territory, but they were looking at a water intake station. And, you know, so this is the kind of argument that starts these kind of fights. So when that happened, it's been going on for so long, no one really thought too much about it. But the next day, very late at night or early the next morning, it started to get much, much worse really quickly. And the amazing thing about this was, whereas the previous conflicts were all localized, you know, involving just a couple of villages in one area. This one just spread out all along the border. all of a sudden, many, many kilometers apart, and involved, yeah. Dozens of villages. And it involved a lot more heavy military equipment, too. Like I said, this is usually shootouts between border guards. There have been, times right. where the Kyrgyz said that the Tajiks fired a couple mortar rounds or used rocket-propelled grenades. But this was absolutely, all out. I mean, they brought up tanks. There was video of Tajik military helicopters flying around, which the Tajiks say was to evacuate civilians from areas where the road was blocked. But the Kyrgyz have shown photos that indicate there was rockets fired from the helicopter, at least on some villages.
Right.
So we've never seen that before. It's always been small, localized, and it was resolved. Right. Or at least peace was restored fairly quickly, because this was something totally different. Yeah.
The number of casualties, the ones which are officially announced on Kyrgyzstani side, where we stand, 36 people died and 187 people injured. And what's the number from Tajikistan?
I think 19 was the last one. Then the officials gave that figure, actually.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring, like officials. I mean, on social media, you see tens of different numbers there. Also, we followed those events with really great concern, the way you were describing, Bruce. You know, what stood out to me in those events was, like, as I said earlier, describing the situation, something in the line of like a war zone atmosphere. So when I was saying that, I was kind of visualizing a video that was prepared by our colleagues on both sides of the border on the ground, which shows people running around nonstop, gunshots are heard, the building's on fire, ambulances are rushing to the hospital. You know, you don't see these kinds of images in Central Asia that often. So what stood out to you in those events, Cholpon?
For me, of course, border disputes always have been there in Central Asia. Kyrgyzstan, for example, has these border disputes with several countries, and with Tajikistan also, we have this half of the old border lines still under dispute. And then, of course, having such a bloody event, bloody conflict with more than 36 casualties, it's such a shock. I never expected this, of course, because I was expecting always that Central Asian countries never will fight, never shoot against each other. And there have been small incidents, one person died or something like that, but never like this. Like, I never imagined that Tajikistan's army can use heavy arms against civilians, So that's why it's such a shock for me. And of course, it's urgent now. First thing is to prevent further escalation. And last days were calm. I'm very happy that finally there is no shooting. But there are concerns and lessons learned should be. First thing for me is, whenever there is a conflict, armed conflict between two countries, first thing for me is establishing the scale of losses and damages. And second thing is accountability and justice for victims.
Right.
And third thing is, there should be political will from both sides to stop escalation.
Right. Children, would you mind if we come back to this topic a little bit later? Of course, certainly we are going to talk about these long-term solution-oriented topics. Before that, I also wanted to take, Hafiz and Madeline's point on this. I mean, Madeline, what Cholpan was talking about is, like, she's shocked by the number of casualties in this particular event compared to the ones we have seen in the past years and months. So what did stand out to you in these particular events?
First of all, I just want to express my really deep and sincere condolences for all those people who have lost loved ones or been displaced or lost homes and livelihoods in this terrible conflict. And I think everybody who observes Central Asia has been, as Cholpon was saying, shocked by the scale of the conflict, the speed at which things escalated.
Yeah.
And I think in answer to your question, Mohammed, really what stood out to me here is the scale and the intensity of the fighting and the use of military equipment against unarmed civilians. I think that is something that is qualitatively new here. I mean, as Bruce said, it's not new that for there to be conflicts in the Isfara Valley.
Right.
And, these go back not just to, the post-Soviet period. They go back deep into the Soviet period, beginning with the 1930s. There have been conflicts over land periodically in the 1950s and the 1970s. And again, in 1989, there were significant incidents, disputes over land and disputes in the case of the 1989 conflict over irrigation water. But what's new here is, in a sense, this intensification of conflict and the militarization of this conflict. And I think that reflects changes that have been happening in the region over the last 10, 15 years with a sort of progressive securitization and militarization of daily life. And I think that sadly, this is in a sense a sort of a reflection of some of those transformations that have been happening over the last years.
Right. It was really useful, the background that you give us. And also, Hafiz, before I move on to expand this discussion, your thoughts on what did stand out to you in these particular events. I mean, you are from Tajikistan, you've grown up looking into these tensions, and you, as part of your research, you have been working on this. So, you know, this particular event, what did stand out to you in this?
Yeah, thanks for this opportunity. Yeah. And I also would like to express my condolence to all people who have been affected by this. I also see somehow a kind of qualitative somehow transformation in such sort of conflicts in border regions, and especially when two state actors involved. Before, like in the case of Tajikistan, I can somehow compare it. There were a lot of kind of clashes, but Tajik state was always took a kind of restrained position and even sometimes punished local residents for being engaged in conflict. And yet we have totally a new situation with involvement of state actors. Of course, not only the side of Tajikistan, but also from the side of Kyrgyzstan.
Madeline, do you like to take this question? I mean, what I hear from all of you is this transformation, the way these things have happened in the past, and now the way on the state level they approach to this tension, the level of their involvement. And you earlier mentioned the scale in which they got involved in this. I mean, what explains this transformation there?
One of the things that I have really observed going back to this region now since the early 2000s is, in a sense, I think we need to situate this sort of what I call this securitization of daily life in the context of the post-Soviet predicament, the desire to have borders and borders that are materially present even before they have been juridically determined. So one of the things that Bruce said right at the start is that we know that, of course, only 519 kilometers of the 972 kilometers of the Kyrgyzstan-Tajikistan border have been juridically delimited and demarcated. But in a sense, the political imperative from post-Soviet independence has been to kind of shore up the border, you know, to materialize the border. So to render these borders that were, you know, de facto invisible in daily life in the Soviet period, to mark them in a particular way, to mark them through infrastructure and to mark them through the presence of the state. So that, you know, whereas 15 years ago, you could easily sort of, you know, travel from Batken to Aksai and you would take the bus and it would go through Charku and Sur and Khojailo, all these, you know, Tajik villages, and the bus would, you know, tap back and forth between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And I took that bus many, many times and it would stop, you know, on the border with Aksai and Varukh. And this bus would be taken by Kyrgyz and Tajik people because it was connecting all of these border villages. What you've seen over the last 15 years is a building of infrastructure, in a sense, roads, to sort of channel life a lot through the national state, right? You know, so that now it's easier to reach, say, the administrative center of Batken, or to connect Batken and Isfana. But one of the consequences of that is that these sort of spaces for everyday sociality, everyday conviviality, encounters on buses, in daily life, in markets, for instance, critical space of kind of cross-border life, these have become increasingly nationalized. And moreover, they have become increasingly sort of seen as strategic objects that therefore need to be protected by the state, and the state not just in the figure of, you know, the policeman or the customs officer, but the state in the figure of the border guard and the border guard who can potentially call upon greater military force. And this is what I mean by this sort of escalation of force that we've seen. What has also been happening is that daily life for people living in border regions then involves encounters with the neighboring state in the figure of the border guard. And there's a scholar in Bishkek whose work I really want to commend, Asiel Mirzakulova, who's done some really great research. And she found that, you know, people's major grievance was the feeling of corruption or of being disrespected by state officials from the neighboring state. And I think that this has sort of compounded, you know, local senses of grievance towards the neighboring state, not necessarily towards neighboring populations, but those two can easily get conflated. You know, there are other pressures, economic pressures, land pressures, water pressures, and so on. But in terms of why it is that there has been a sort of turn towards resolving with Awuye conflicts over water and resources through force, I think we need to understand it in this context of the sort of the securitization of the border.
Right. Yeah. You know, that's kind of brings us to Bruce's article earlier that I mentioned, the way things have turned from stick and stone to guns and bombs. Cholpan, you want to say something? Please jump in quickly.
Yeah. Regarding the why the conflict has changed recently.
The dynamics, yeah. The dynamics
of conflict. Dynamics. So I see two reasons, political and socioeconomic. First, when it comes to the socioeconomic, the leaders of Central Asia, they have been just ignoring the problems, everyday problems of the people, local people. Instead of addressing urgent issues related to border, roads, and water, the especially long-serving presidents, they were really busy by consolidating their power. So, for example, Tajik president has the only thing in his mind, how to strengthen his family role and transition of power to his son. So as for Kyrgyzstan, we are having revolutions, and each time president comes with own weaknesses. And the main problem is in both countries, also special services and law enforcement agencies are busy by intimidating, surveying, interrogating opposition, civil society, and independent journalists. So this is also a socioeconomic problem. So, and there is climate change, water scarcity. So that's why the local people, they are really tired of these problems. But at the same time, we have to admit that in this conflict, I don't see direct engagement of local people, especially from Tajikistan side, because I don't believe that Tajik people, they came and burned houses. I don't believe this. For example, today, local journalist from Kyrgyzstan, Idris Isakov, he went to the Tajikistan side and he interviewed local people. And they said, we don't know these people. And they told him that only military responsible for everything. And second, political side. For me, the position of Tajikistan's president is really varied. I don't see his clear position on this conflict because I see also Russia's hand in this conflict. And the, for example, there was a gathering of OSCE when the conflict erupted. And then this organization didn't discuss this issue. The lesson from this conflict for Kyrgyzstan, for example, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan also, they should build multi-vector foreign policy, positively engage with US, EU, all the global community, and to get out from the wing of Russia, stop becoming the climate state of Russia. And then, for example, EU. EU could contribute to peaceful resolution of border conflicts, but Russia never helped.
Very interesting point. So, Hafiz, is there anything you would like to add from Tajikistan's perspective in this?
In the light of what Madeleine and Cholpan have discussed, I would like to somehow connect between securitization of border region and also consolidation of power. Like, I'm taking both sides, both Kyrgyz and Tajik side, how they're somehow trying to consolidate their power through securitization of border region. Like in the case of Tajikistan, for example, before the, I would say, provocative statement of Toshiev, there was a kind of status quo. President Emomali Rahmon enjoyed kind of status quo, and his power was not so significantly challenged. And he and his circle, including delegation, also were silent, and they didn't make any comment on the provocative statement of Toshiev.
Who's Toshiev, Hafiz?
All things,
Hafiz, who's Toshiev?
The chairperson of security committee of Kyrgyz government.
I'm just playing dumb here, so just so that our audience know who we are really referring to.
Okay, right, yeah. So I think it was on the 3rd of April, yes, his statement about weekends, like he told in a press conference that we have two options. One, we can change Voruch with another territory in Botkent province. And the other one, yeah, to retain Voruch and demarcate and delimitate the border region. It was on the 3rd of April, and the Tajik side didn't answer to this statement. And in 1, 2, 3 weeks, many people were engaged in this discussion and from Tajik side. And they believe that Tajik and Kyrgyz sides, they agreed to somehow to change Voruch region with another region in Botkent province. And this created a kind of atmosphere of fear and chaos. And also many opposition groups, also exiled opposition, were engaged that in this kind of discussion that Tajik state should somehow take kind of military action.
Earlier, Tolpan was raising that Tajikistan's president's position on these issues has never been clear. Do you know what he wants, where he stands in all these tension?
I mean, like before this provocative statement, his position was not clear because he was enjoying a status quo. But then his government suddenly changed the position because his authority was challenged. And now I think he's very actively engaged in securitization of border region. But again, there are a lot of uncertainties.
Right. Yeah.
Like in social media, there are a lot of information flowing.
We are taken. Yeah, we are not even going to social media. There are so many stuff being said.
And can I comment? Is it possible?
Yeah, quickly, please. Yeah. Yes.
I heard from several experts from Tajikistan referring to Tashiyev's statement. And usually in international relations, if there is a statement which another country doesn't like, there should be diplomatic note or statement or commentary from the official sources, official authorities from that country. So why Tajikistan didn't make any comments or statements or diplomatic notes, but instead used heavy arms against civilians? This I don't understand.
Very interesting. I think we will not be able to get out of this political debate if we get into this, but certainly it is something that people are talking about, which is important. And Bruce, maybe the last part of our conversation with Hafiz and Chulpan brought me to another very concerning development. You know, I just want to be cautious here. I hope this news is not coming out of those social media debates, or maybe it's not one of those, the product of troll factory there. But since it's been said officially by the authorities of those countries, that's why I am kind of cautiously bringing this up with you. And that is about the news or the allegations about the deportation of, I guess we are talking about here, ethnic Kyrgyz. What do we know about this?
The one from Laksh, Jigira.
I have no idea from which city, which town, but I just saw this,
Okay. There's actually some legal grounds for this, and it's not something that just started now.
Okay.
We're talking about Jirgatal. There are Kyrgyz in that area, and it's further east than where these border incidents were, who have dual citizenship, and they're both Tajik and Kyrgyz citizens. Some of them might even have a home or something in Kyrgyzstan, too. Now, Kyrgyz and Tajik laws do not permit their citizens to be dual citizens of either one of those countries. Like in Kyrgyzstan, you can be a Russian citizen, you can be a Kyrgyz citizen, but you can't be a Kyrgyz citizen and a Tajik citizen. And same is true in Tajikistan. You can't be both Kyrgyz and Tajik citizens. So, and like I said, this started several weeks ago, and it might be related to border tensions, but it's not a result of what just happened last week, where they gave them a choice, that you're one or the other. You either stay here and you're a Tajik citizen, or you go back to Kyrgyzstan and renounce your Tajik citizenship.
Okay. Good to know that. So as bad as things were over the past few days, the good thing is, I think things are apparently calm today, and authorities have decided to meet on the highest level. I guess presidents will be meeting soon, which is great. As they are preparing to meet, though, what are some of the possible areas that they need to explore? Is there anything that can help? Is there anyone who can help in this situation? While the event was unfolding, what's kind of struck me was also this policy position that one of the regional organizations have expressed earlier. I guess Chulpan was referring to that collective security treaty or Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They had some kind of interesting policy statement being released on those days. Maybe they can be a player in resolving this issue, or maybe they should play a role. I don't know. So let's continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions very shortly in the context of how we get out of this situation. The First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Madeline Rivas, a senior lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Manchester, Cholpan Orozbekova, head of the Geneva-based Bolan Institute for Peace and Innovation, Hafiz Bobayorov, currently a guest researcher at the Bonn University in Germany, previously with the Academy of Science in Tajikistan, Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Free Liberties, Central Asia Bloc, Kishlok Owazi. I'm Mohamed Tahir, Ready for Free Liberties Media Manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. And we are trying to understand the latest tension on the Kyrgyz-Tajik border. I know we have a couple of minutes left with you, Madeline. Maybe let me start with you here. We kind of spoke about this earlier in terms of the intensification of these tensions on the border. But it's interesting to see is, like, while tension is on the rise in this specific location, the encouraging news from the other side is, like, recently, I think 2-3 weeks ago, Uzbek and Kyrgyz president met in Tashkent, and they said, you know, we have resolved all the problems. While problems can be resolved there, tension is on the rise in this specific spot. I mean, what is wrong with this spot? What is that they cannot resolve this issue? And also, you know, we are talking about these border issues, borders dispute, these lines that are cutting the villages from each other. I mean, they know that the authorities in Central Asia and both sides of the border, they know that this is source of a tension. And I'm sure that they are thinking about it. But what is blocking any progress?
Well, I mean, it is to be welcomed if there are high-level meetings now, because I think what's really important is to have the political will to resolve long-standing border issues, particularly the issues of demarcation and delimitation, but also issues of access, of use rights, of the distribution of water. You know, it's not insignificant that this particular conflict started over Galavnoy, this water distribution point, which is really critical for irrigating large parts of this region. And, you know, for instance, the whole of Batken town depends on the water coming from this canal system into the Tokun Reservoir. So it's really important, I think, to resolve these issues at a juridical level. To answer your question, Mohammed, why are there these enduring conflicts here? I think if we ask from the perspective of local populations, I think there have been talks going on over delimitation of the border here going back to 2002. Yeah. And, you know, there were parity commissions throughout the Soviet period, you know, the last of which, there was a parity commission in 1989, which the work of which was truncated. It was, there were attempts to restart its work in 1990, and then events were overtaken by the civil war in Tajikistan and the collapse of the Soviet Union. So I think there has to be the political will to address issues of delimitation and demarcation, and to recognize that this isn't going to be a quick fix solution. And to that extent, you know, I agree with Hafiz that Tashiev's comment about Varukh was experienced in Tajikistan as extremely provocative. Now, and I want to stress that I agree with Cholpon that the response to that should have been a diplomatic response rather than a military response. But I think it's really important to recognize that a juridical solution here, you know, it's not a case of a quick fix, and it has to involve local populations. Certainly from my research, one of the things that I encountered a great deal was a sense of frustration at the slow pace of the talks in the post-Soviet period going back to 2002, and the sense that local voices weren't being listened to, that people, you know, local people weren't being involved in these discussions. So I think it's critical that there's political will, and I think it's critical that there is, in a sense, political imagination, by which I mean thinking about solutions to the issues of these complex, you know, shakhmatni granitsi, right? These chessboard type borders. There are imaginative solutions to these that aren't framed in terms of needing to displace large populations in order to resolve them. When I say political imagination, I think it would be really significant, for instance, to try to bring in, for instance, into these technical discussions, people who've been involved in resolving issues around enclaves on the India-Bangladesh border, for instance. You know, there were a whole series of enclaves on that border. And in 2015, there were agreements that were reached. You know, to bring in technical expertise to say, what could be some solutions here from which both sides can benefit, economic solutions. You know, so I think that there needs to be the political will.
Right.
There needs to be the involvement of all populations. And critically, I think now in the current situation of intense sort of escalation, and for many people on both sides of the border, feelings of sort of existential fear and threat, I think there needs to be a de-escalation of the sort of military presence.
Right. And also, I'm wondering, since you mentioned, and again, we see this sporadic news coming out of Central Asia, these commissions meet, and after every escalation, certainly there are delegations exchanging ideas and talking, calming down people. We have seen those discussions taking place occasionally in Central Asia, Madeline. What I'm wondering is, maybe they cannot solve this issue by sitting with each other. Maybe there are some other players needs to get involved in that. What I'm saying is, like, maybe United Nations, maybe, I don't know, OSCE, whatever organization is relevant, maybe they need to get intervened. I mean, certainly we have seen this escalation is rising. You know, this the latest tension has shown us it's dangerous. It's taking a dangerous shape. Chorban, you
can
want?
Can I say?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. De-escalation of the situation, I see two ways. First is commitment of both sides to de-escalation. I mean here high level, presidents of two countries.
Right.
What I was expecting immediately, I was expecting that two presidents will be making joint statement expressing their political will to come to the negotiation table, you know. But this didn't happen.
And I thought they are going to meet, right? Aren't they?
Yeah. Second thing, they have to meet, of course, but not in Dushanbe, not in Bishkek, in a third country, maybe Kazakhstan, but without any interference of Russia. Not, you mentioned OSCE organization. I think it's better to involve United Nations or EU or OSCE. So, and then second thing, I think accountability is very important. For this, many civil society also in Kyrgyzstan, we demand to hold international investigation of the conflict, to restore chronology of the conflict, how it started, how it arisen, you know, the whole process. It is very important for victims, because attacking civilians is a war crime. So Tajikistan used very heavy arms against civilians. So we need to take lessons learned from this conflict to avoid further escalation of the conflict. So this is very important. So that's why Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, they should help to investigate this conflict. We already sent a letter, but the problem is both organizations, they have very small Central Asia sections where one or two staff members only. But for this, I think there should be commitment of other donor organizations, EU or other organizations, because this process demands financial and human resources, huge resources. Both sides are blaming each other.
Yeah.
Both sides. Civilian casualties are in Kyrgyzstan's side. We have 33 civilians killed out of 36 victims.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know whether it was just a bluff or something like that. I mean, authorities in both countries also launched kind of criminal investigations against the military forces of the opposing country there. I don't know whether anything could come out of that or not. But while we are kind of going towards the end of our conversation here, Bruce, maybe let me also bring you in here. Now that this has happened, what comes next? What should come next? I mean, we have heard Cholpan's ideas that she was presenting in terms of the accountability, transparency, lessons learned kind of ideas. Now, what should happen now? What should come next from your perspective?
Well, you know, I thought Madeline put it just perfectly, that, that you really need to involve the local communities in this, like, so much more than they have it. I mean, let's face it, you know, we've been talking about Tashiev's statement, you know, well, let's just trade Baruch. I think he wanted to trade it for Samarkandek. That's a naive proposal. It didn't go anywhere immediately, and it was taken wrong by the people on the ground, and it shows that he wasn't consulting with the people on the ground, or he never would have made such a proposal, you know. You know, when people say, well, they need to demarcate the border, you know, that'll solve a lot of things, and I agree. But, you know, Madeline's been through this area, and maybe, I don't know if Chopin and Harpies have been. When you think of demarcating a border, and you think of, like, putting up fences, like the barbed wire fences along the Uzbek-Kyrgyz border in a lot of places or something, the way just the physical landscape of this place, you can't even imagine that something like that could happen. And you're going to put border posts up where? Every time you cross the border, where, you know, like Madeline said on the bus, you're crossing back and forth all the time. There's times when you're down the road and one side of the street is Kyrgyzstan and one side of the street is Tajikistan. Where do you, you know, how do you put up something that's a marker to show people that's it? So you can't physically divide them since you can't do that, the better solution is to try to work out something that appeals to everybody, the economic benefit or something that everybody gets out of this. And it's going to take a lot of creative work, but you can have a de facto border there. But if you can convince people that they get more out of it just by not building a wall and by getting along and doing stuff, that would also be an effective border there too. You know, but and to get back to why I think this all started from, you also got to remember that this area didn't get hardly any attention, you know, in the first decade of independence. I mean, you know, Tajikistan, of course, was worried about most of the fighting was in the south or up in the mountains, a little bit east of where we're talking about. And they had the Afghan border. Mm-hmm. Kyrgyzstan had its own problems and stuff. And it really wasn't until the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan's militants showed up there that they paid a lot of attention to this area. So their first things that got their attention was a security problem along the border. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of set the tone for their policies toward that border ever since.
Mm-hmm. Hafiz, do you like to add anything into what we are talking about? Like, I mean, what really needs to happen now at this stage? Go ahead.
Yeah, shortly, I want to somehow highlight some points. First of all, military involvement is in no way admittable from both sides. This is the first, but unfortunately, the problem is again with the nature of power in both countries, and in future there can be some problems in border region. I would imagine that maybe somehow involve some international actors, for example, UN mission. Also, I agree with Bruce that like dividing people physically is very difficult, especially in this region, in Voruch, in Fergana Valley. And it is not only technically, but also from human perspective, is not easy. And therefore, we need not only international actors, but also this conflict shows that civil society and mass media are not only weak, I mean, as a cooperation between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, between civil society and mass media is weak. And also they're not ready in such occasions. And I would expect that in future, civil society and mass media cooperate with each other and share their information. Like in Tajikistan, where we feel kind of hungry of information from the Kyrgyz side, and Kyrgyz also have such problem. And
plenty of information coming from Kyrgyzstan.
Sorry?
In Kyrgyzstan, free media, all independent journalists, they reached the conflict zone and they have plenty of information.
We
from Tajikistan, actually.
We don't hear the Kyrgyz perspective. I mean this. Maybe Kyrgyz also don't hear our perspective. And therefore, we need some kind of bridging attempt, like through civil society and mass media, some kind of regional mass media. We have some regional mass media like represented like in Russia. We have some, but they're not the solution. Yeah, thanks.
Right, yeah. Open up the environment of press freedom. You will get lots of those sources of information there. But also, you know, speaking of mass media, this time, you know, when I was researching about this topic over the last few days, and I went through lots of social media comments, I mean, the interest by the social media commentators on this issue was a kind of very interesting and also on a different level. And maybe we have forgotten the social media's reaction to events that has happened in this area before, like last time, but this time it was just out of context. It was just not helpful. It was just in case of the social media, someone is only source of information, that person would understand, okay, we are about to
get divided. Yes, sir.
Get divided.
Social media is also divided, unfortunately.
It was very, very dangerous. Discussions were taking place there. But yeah, we need to really end the conversation. Madeline, are you with us?
I'm here. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'm listening to all that's been said.
So let's end the conversation with last point. So now that these things has happened, and of course, helpful ideas were also presented here on this platform. Of course, authorities there on the ground, they must be talking about, and regional leaders must be talking about. You know, when I talk to our Uzbek, colleagues, and they say Mirziyoyev was also active in kind of calming down this latest round of tension. Maybe that's true. But what I'm saying is, like, there has to be discussion going on in various places how to resolve this issue. Let's hope that it will reach to certain terms, like, you know, especially in the context the two presidents are planning to meet, which is really great. Now, going forward, where your eyes will be to determine where we are headed with this?
Well, I think there are immediate issues, of course, to address in terms of humanitarian aid, reconstruction of homes. And as Cholpon, I think, put it very well, you know, the sense of hunger for justice and for accountability and for transparency and for establishing a chronology of what's happened. And I think that's absolutely essential. And in a sense, that the media situation that, you know, you touched upon briefly, Mohammed, in your comments, and this environment of proliferation of allegations and so on social media, that flourishes in an environment where there isn't a free media operating. And I think we can, you know, particularly in Tajikistan, the kind of difficulty even of establishing, for instance, getting official figures about numbers of casualties and so on, really reflects an environment in which the media have been really stifled. So issues of accountability, transparency will be critical for establishing justice. I think that's an immediate need. Longer term, there are, as I say, I think for sort of imaginative political solutions. I mean, at the moment, the recent announcement yesterday on the day of speaking about building a new road around Kapjirai, Tangi, you know, that would link Hojailo and Varuh, that may be a certain kind, you know, there's this tendency to seek solutions in more infrastructure, right? If we can just build another road, this may help solve an issue. Now, that may help solve an issue for, in the immediate sense of people being able to travel safely between Hojailo and Varuh without having stones thrown at vehicles, because stone throwing on vehicles is an issue for people living on both sides of the border. But in a sense, there need to be longer term solutions to create durable forms of peace in the Asfara Valley. And I think that is really long term work. And, you know, I want to commend the work of organizations like the Foundation for Tolerance International that have been working in Samanyon, in Kuktash, you know, in among initiatives among young people, for instance. These things are really critical. But in a sense, they are, you know, drops in the ocean in a context of an environment of increasing nationalist rhetoric on both sides of the border, in a context where, you know, again, young people in Kuktash and Samanyon very often don't have even a common language to be able to communicate with each other in, you know, and that's different from a generation ago when Russian might have served as that lingua franca and so on. So there are, I think, really, you know, there needs to be a lot of attention from the international community of long-term solutions that involve the local community and not just men. I think, you know, when we see the images of Tashiev meeting with Batken Aktivisti, I'm really struck how gendered these images are that we see, you know, that solutions need to involve all sectors of the population, all demographics, men and women, and that really start from a position of seeking to understand another person's perspective. And this tendency to sort of seek singular truths, right? If we can just find, you know, the single map that is the truth, you know, which is the right map. In a sense, we have to start from the fact that there are people now living in Varuh, living in Aksai, living in Tojikon, living in areas some may consider disputed and some may not consider disputed. But we have to start from the fact of people's lives and the fact that this is a very, very densely populated area. We have to start from that, in a sense, that existential reality, and start to find solutions on that basis. I think, you know, really listening carefully to the perspective of the other side, rather than starting from a perspective of trying to make loud statements that might appeal to a particular political constituency within one's country, but which are not actually conducive to creating durable peace.
Okay, I think it's a really nice conclusive remarks. Bruce, is there anything we have missed today?
You know, I'd just say, see what happens when Putin and Rahman meet in Moscow, and then watch what happens when Tokayev shows up in Dushanbe, which I believe is May 19th and 20th.
Okay, we will keep our eyes open on that. Okay.
Is there a chance for final word or not?
Quickly.
So as a final word, I would like to say that it's really important transparency from both sides. And I would like to urge both countries to share information, to be open, and also to state their position clearly. After the conflict, there was an information vacuum from Tajikistan's side. We couldn't get any information. And inside country, inside Tajikistan also, my friends, my colleagues, they were telling me that they didn't know what's happening. So there was no press release, nothing. So from this point, it's really important between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan to have transparency, information sharing. And, you know, in this conflict, What I noticed is that we really understood the role of independent media and civil society. Because from Kyrgyzstan's side also, maybe the authorities were not ready to share information, but independent journalists themselves, they reached the conflict zone and they started reporting. So we learned it like this. So we understood how this strong civil society and independent journalism is very important.
Right, right. Yeah, our colleagues like Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Tajik Service, they were also on the ground on the other side of the border. They have been reporting earlier. I was referring to this video that I saw. I mean, this was the kind of joint collaboration between these two groups of reporters on the Kyrgyz side and also on the Tajik side. But I do hear you, Cholpan. There needs to be more transparency. There needs to be more openness. You know, it's important to understand what's going on, the scale of things that are going on. Yeah, with this, I think we need to conclude the discussion here. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us. Dr. Madeline Reeves, a senior lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Manchester, Cholpan Orozbekova, head of the Geneva-based Bulan Institute for Peace, Innovations and Research, Hafiz Boboyorov, a researcher at the Bonn University in Germany, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Again, thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.